And here we are, beautiful August 30th, 2001. Stay tuned, late, but we're coming at you. Bathroom Spears broadside.
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, Television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe.
Bill Vaughn, a notorious activist known for his activities against depleted uranium weapons and other necessary implements of war. What have you been up to?
Well, I just lost my forest home to the University Popo. They paid me a visit and gave me my eviction, so to speak.
Right.
And so that's my home. That's where all my stuff is, and I have to clear it all out and go to court. So it's kind of put me in a crisis right now as far as my living situation.
Now, are you unique in this, or have they been going after other people as well? What's the situation up there? This is on campus?
Yeah, it's up on campus. They've been busting people, you know, periodically, pretty regularly, actually.
And how long had you been up there before they busted you?
I was there for about a year and a half.
Wow.
So you had a long run. Were you snitched out, or what happened?
No, the campus cops did a sweep, and they found my place, unfortunately. And they periodically do sweeps up there, look for places. I guess they have nothing better to do than to bust people who are not causing any damage. Generally, all the people I know that live up there are very respectful of the land and probably are living more sustainably than 99.9% of the average American, you know.
Take it. How can people be helpful and assist you and others up there?
I think
by supporting Camp Paradise.
It's the same idea, I guess. You know, people are trying to live more sustainably in Camp Paradise, and they're getting hassled while the people who are the real criminals, you know, get away, and they're the ones that are running the country. So, I mean, people need to be more supportive in general of houseless people or people who don't own a home or can't afford rent, that they still have a right to exist and a right to be a part of the community.
All right. Thank you, Bill. All right. It's 5:25.
What?
For what?
What did I do?
Blocking the sidewalk.
I'm blocking the sidewalk. I'm behind the tables. I'm supporting.
Give me your ID.
I'm blocking the tables that I'm supporting.
You're refusing to give me your ID?
Are you telling me that I'm blocking the sidewalk with
you? And good evening. It's, as usual, somewhat hustled and rushed, but still here in the bidi-bidi-ing, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. It's your Free Radio Santa Cruz Civil Rights on the Streets show. Lots of broadcasters actually are concerned about civil rights. I make it a fetish here and keep at it. For 2 hours here on 96.3, we will be covering the issue. I had hoped to have two guests with us. One, a man I ran into in the dreaded courtroom of referee John Mulligan, but apparently he has not made his way to the studio. Very interesting case of an example of a man who was actually trying to appeal a ruling of referee Mulligan, something which Camp Paradise people or other homeless people who are, in my mind, foolish enough to leave their tickets in Mulligan's courtroom. You should always disqualify Mulligan, but if you don't, then that's where they'll be, because that's where all the infraction tickets generally go. They may need that information, because you may want to appeal the ruling that referee Mulligan gives you, which is usually a ruling in favor of the police department, unless there is a indisputable example of innocence, or there's a large press coverage and there's a lot of people watching. Then I found Mulligan tends to act perhaps somewhat differently. And that, of course, doesn't cover all cases, but it's happened enough so that I invariably advise people to disqualify Mulligan, who is the, again, the referee in the basement of the county building who hears almost every single infraction case, unless you do disqualify him. It's easy to do. You just go to the window next to his courtroom and state you believe he's prejudiced. You don't have to prove it. You just got to believe it. Swear a statement to that effect and sign it and say, I want it sent to another court, and that's where they'll send it, usually to one of the two commissioners, Commissioner Siegel or Commissioner Joseph. And those disadvantage there is you have to make a separate arraignment date a week or two down the road. And then if you want to go to trial, as you probably should, because that's the whole point of taking these cases to court, is to go to trial with them, you'll get a trial in front of a judge a week later. And they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a judge's satisfaction, not a jury's satisfaction, that you are guilty of the crime. In this case, the crime will be, for many Camp Paradise people ticketed on August 3rd, setting up an encampment with the intention of remaining overnight. That's the wording of the infamous camping ban section of the law, of the camping ordinance that they're charged with. I want to thank particularly Mookie for covering the show. Have a good one, Mookie. He's taken off, and he'll be back next week. I guess his show begins at 4, if I'm not mistaken. So if you want to be in on this show, if you got questions you want to ask or about stuff that you've heard on the air or stuff you've heard on the streets or, hey, anything at all, think of me as your oracle. Give me a call at 427-3772. I am not a lawyer. I am a man of spent entirely too much time around the courts, usually on homeless civil rights issues. And so I know a few things about certain code sections and certain judicial procedures. And I'm interested more in your stories and what you've been doing, what you've been seeing, and what you've been concerned with out there. Because often homeless people or people in their vehicles or people even in their apartments don't have much of a chance to get their story out to the media and out to folks because they're a little gun-shy, a little mic-shy. They're not encouraged to speak to the community, as we should be, because the community is indeed, it's our community. It may not seem that way, but it is. We all of us, believe it or not, even though we're in our separate little rooms, seemingly in our separate little lives, share a lot in common that we're not aware of, and I think we become aware of
in many respects, a common kind of oppression, whether it's landlords or large corporations or an indifferent city and state and federal government. We would become aware of that if we reached out to each other and communicated with each other, and that's what I think really the primary value of free radio is. It enables us to do that. At least that's one of its primary values. So give a call to 427-3772, 427-FRSC. You want to talk on the air on this or any other issue. And also, if you want to catch me off air, you won't be able to catch me today, but you will be able to leave me a message on the Huff line. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and the number is appropriately enough 423-HUFF, 423-4833. 423-HUFF. Just leave a message there and I'll try to get back to you. If you haven't got a phone, try to indicate where you are during the next day and maybe we can rendezvous. And that's also if you want to sell Street Spirits. Street Spirits, the homeless newspaper, comes out once a month, published in San Francisco, but it has stories usually from Santa Cruz. Compliments of those fine writers, Becky Johnson and myself, with occasional assistance from other people, Linda LeMaster, Sherry Connable, other people who are local articulate homeless activists who have got something to say about the scene down here, and they say it very well. You can read about it in the Street Spirit. In the last issue, the August issue, had a long story on Camp Paradise. Actually, the last two issues have had long stories on Camp Paradise, and that's the camp, of course, for those of you who don't know, that's right near Denny's restaurant on Ocean Street. You go down to Felker Street, which is the street on the right of Denny's, go to the levee, the San Lorenzo River, and right before you get there, there's a little kind of trail heading off to the right and goes down under the underpass, a foot trail. You walk down the foot trail, you go under the bridge, the underpass, and you walk up river about 200, 300, 400, 500 yards, and you'll find Camp Paradise, which is a very, they're very hospitable to visitors. They have their own internal conflicts, as all camps and all communities do, and but they are a group of people who are many of them employed, some of them passing through, some of them families with children who have no housing in Santa Cruz other than the camp or their vehicles. They help each other. They support each other. They provide a relatively clean and safe environment for each other, much more so than they would be if they were living alone, and perhaps even if they were in the local Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which is, of course, nothing more than a series of buses that take you to the floor of a church, if you're lucky enough to get in, and that only happens for 39 people every night. Usually all the spaces are filled, according to Karen Brock at the Homeless Services Center. So it's for the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people that live here in Santa Cruz each night, not to mention the 6,000 to 10,000 in the county, it's no-go status as far as any kind of legality goes, and everyone faces the threat of tickets, the threat of beatings, the threat of accidental injury, because if you have any kind of a large campsite, you have to worry about the police finding it or seeing it or not liking it or thinking it's another Camp Paradise, you know, coming around. They don't want more than one, for heaven's sakes, or to, you know, they don't want everybody to have the right to sleep at night. There's been some critical talk about Camp Paradise. The police are leaving Camp Paradise alone, but they're going after other campsites. And that may well be true, but that's because Camp Paradise has organized. And I indeed think that's what other campsites need to do. They need to get together and organize. And indeed, I was hoping that the Vehicular Residents Association that had sort of begun, and they did actually get, there was quite a substantial number, five or six or seven people with vehicles that came Wednesday before last to the Huff meeting at Baker Square. That's every morning at 8:30 on Wednesday. We all gather at this little restaurant on Ocean Street called Baker Square and try to figure out what to do next. Unfortunately, yesterday there weren't many people there, and I had hoped that one of the vehicular residents that we ran into who was going to come to this particular show today, and he had some really gripping stories of how he was a merchant in the Soquel area who lost his business, and he's now living in a vehicle out on the Harvey West, and Harvey West is just covered with vehicles now. I mean, it looks like there's more vehicles there now than there were a year ago when the city council was babbling about a safe sleeping zone there, and the police, some merchants, and some right-wing council members like Rotkin and Hernandez were sabotaging that particular effort, and then it was sold out by Catherine Byers. And again, it's been sold out more recently by Sugar Crone and Fitzmaurice, and the entire city council have refused to raise the issue of either safe sleeping zones or any modifications of the city's infamous camping ordinance or sleeping and blanket and camping bans, which are parts of that camping ordinance. So that in rapid Robert fashion, and I'm Robert Norris, in case you haven't met me. How do you do? Come and talk on the phone if you got questions or comments or thoughts on any of these issues. 427-3772. I've got my eye on the phone flasher, so I will. You flash at me, and I'll bite immediately, and we'll be able to hear what you got to say. And it's been an interesting week, in many respects. I was ringing the alarm bell for Camp Paradise for the last 2 weeks because it didn't seem to me that there was any guarantees that the police wouldn't come any particular day, since the campers had rejected a proposal by Fitzmaurice, actually a proposal by Paul Sanford, I understand, their attorney, which got the okay from Emperor, Mayor, Fuhrer, council member, what you will, Brady Cat Fitzmaurice, the UC instructor who is now our mayor in Santa Cruz, who has also been a Green Party member, but who fails to follow the Green Party platform of no sleeping bans and no attacks on the homeless. We heard some good news that the police have not come yet. There was this proposal, and it was sort of, if everybody left the camp, their tickets given on August 3rd would all be thrown away, and they said, no, ain't going to do it. Anyway, we got a phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I'm just wondering how you would do things differently if you were on the city council.
On the city council?
How would you do things differently, so if you could fill the
air? Sure. Do you want me to do it on the air, or, I mean, on the phone? You want to take the call on the air? Do you want to...
I'll take it off the air.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I would never run for city council because I believe the institution of city council corrupts the people who get into it. Almost invariably. It's hard to think of anybody in the last 25 years who's gotten on the city council that I would generally support in terms of his positions on civil rights for homeless people. But let's imagine, let's really get real visionary. First of all, in order to run for city council, what you'd need to do is you'd need to have a shadow staff. You would need to have people who are experts in different areas of city administration who are you can rely on, rather than the institutionalized, heavily paid clowns who are currently in the city positions, who have their own agenda and who pretty much get their own agenda, whether it's in the beach flats giving away property to the Seaside Company or letting the Seaside Company retain its traditional privileged theft of the tide lands and other properties that it occupies, or whether it's people who are in the Public Works Department who refuse to set up porta potties and dumpsters in the industrial zones, even as the City Council has voted unanimously to do back in February of 1999, at least the porta potties, bathrooms actually, was what was done, but porta potties would be an improvement over crapping in the bushes and getting all the neighbors all upset so that they start screaming about the homeless folks or people in their vehicles. You'd need to have people who could give you straight information. You'd need to have a sort of a parallel staff. And this is what I've told, for example, Michael Schmidt, who is running for the Board of Supervisors, which is an even more difficult and all-encompassing position, and also much more highly paid. City council members get, I think, $1,000 or $2,000. Supervisors get $70,000. So there's actually some, you can actually support yourself from that position if you're a supervisor. And Schmidt is running for Marty Wormhout's position as supervisor, and anybody but Marty Wormhout is my motto at the moment, even though some people have pointed out Schmidt is heavily backed by business interests. He's got positions that not all of us will agree with in terms of business over environmental concerns, though Schmidt and I have not talked about this at length. I've just noticed his very strong, forthright, uncompromising homeless positions, pro-homeless civil rights positions, which I regard as... frankly, a litmus test for me, and I stand by that. But what would I do? I know positions I take on particular issues because I've talked about them on the air. Obviously, I would move to end the sleeping ban if that, and I probably couldn't even get a second for that. I mean, maybe I could, because I think I would try to. If I couldn't get an initial motion passed, I would hold discussion groups. I would try to hold subcommittee meetings. I would have regular meetings with the public rather than have the public essentially have to file in and have 3 minutes once every 2 weeks if they're lucky, and if they don't use the word, for example, fascist or Nazi, which now apparently Fuhrer Fitzmaurice feels rings a little too true in his council chambers and finds a bit too offensive. So if you use that word, you won't be allowed to speak. That's what he's told me. And Mayor Keith Sugar has sort of seconded that. That's the great liberal attorney, Keith Sugar, on the city council. So what would I do? Well, really, I'm an advocate in certain areas, and I don't consider myself an expert in all areas at all. And so that's the reason, that's often the reason city council members, I think, who maybe begin as principled advocates, let's say, let's look at Christopher Crone. I never noticed Christopher Crone doing lots and lots, but he did, for example, show up at crowds that supported the homeless services, the homeless garden project over the Pelton Street Palaces, as they call them, which were passed by the Rotkin Kennedy City Council back in 1998. They, you know, gave away the land on which the homeless garden project sits to, they sold it to, you know, make large, fancy, luxury homes. And Crone was one of the people who opposed that, and he was there, and he was also, of course, one of the key people who fought the Beach South of Laurel plan, which was the huge city boondoggle giveaway to Canfield, which was defeated, and now, of course, is being passed piecemeal by the same people who originally defeated it. But he seemed to be different before he got on the council. Now, and he actually was the only council member who used to hold weekly meetings, or I should say biweekly meetings. The Monday before the Tuesday of city council meetings, council member Christopher Crone would meet with everyone who wanted to at the Pergolesi Cafe and explain the agenda and, you know, take input, as he put it. I got the impression, however, that he was sort of like a superior teacher, kind of looking down from above, who let the class chatter and then kind of folded up his briefcase and took off without really hearing much of what was said or responding in any committed or meaningful way. And half the time, when he would respond to you and say he would do something, he didn't. Although half the time he did. So, I mean, there was, I guess you got a 50% or not quite sure what the ratio was, response from Councilmember Crone. And you did get him to meet with you in a public way regularly. He doesn't do that anymore, whether it's because his wife has a second child or because the people who show up at his meetings, like myself and Ed Davidson and Scott Graham, are regular critics that he doesn't want to face and doesn't, feel he needs to talk to and doesn't want anything to do with. Whatever that is, he no longer does that. This is a tradition of meeting with the public that was established initially by supervisor Gary Patton back in the 80s. He used to hold these meetings at the old Cafe Zeno, went before the earthquake, when it was in back of the old bookshop Santa Cruz on Pacific Avenue in the 80s. And it's a good tradition. I mean, they're still dealing with snotty, arrogant, too busy to talk to you politicians. And Patton, I feel, even though he was better than most, you know, still was somewhat in that category. He is now, you know, kind of a revered elder statesman. And I mean, he's never come out against the sleeping ban or for civil rights for homeless people in Santa Cruz City, for example, although he did help to stop a drive to establish a county camping ban in the 80s and set up some good legislation in the mid-80s, but that's really about the last thing he did other than, you know, a series of environmental measures that earned him a lot of plaudits from folks who were interested in low growth. And again, the problem with all the low growth stuff is that if it's coupled with squeezing out poor people, it results essentially in a gentrification of a sort of a playground for the rich. And that's a problem. I mean, I don't favor these large commercial developments, but I think that, you know, you also need somehow to take into account low-income people, not just with boondoggle giveaways to Mercy Charities housing, like the Dolphin Lee destruction that creates less housing and destroys more housing than it creates. So it's a difficult situation. I would really think that you need, as I said again, to have a working kind of brain trust that's accessible to the public. You would need to also, in essence, continue to be an activist primarily rather than simply a city council member. And that's the way that you would maintain some real integrity and some real contact with the community. But it's not a job I'd want to do. I think it might even be an impossible job. I don't mean to sound cynical about American representative forms of government. I don't want to say democracy, because it's not democracy. It's plutocracy. And it's a sort of a gentrifocracy. You know, it's a rule by the gentry. You don't get, you know, down-home people in there much. Occasionally you do, but generally not. So that's my answer to that question. And got any other questions, call into 427-3772. Got any answers, call into 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. 96.3 is what you're listening to. And I didn't prepare as much for today as perhaps I need to, although I usually can talk forever if I have to, but because I had assumed, again, that we had two guests. One, as I said, this fellow who was conducting his own appeal of a Mulligan decision in Mulligan's court. And Mulligan was talking about what's called a settled statement. And I'll talk about that in a moment after this phone call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I have one other question for you.
Aha, yes.
I'm wondering where you live currently, where you are residing.
Does this mean you want to come and visit me?
No, I'm wondering if you're homeless.
No, I'm not.
You're fucking hitting on me. Yeah, you fucking
I am not hitting on you. But I appreciate your candor.
One other question?
Sure.
Oh, wait. So where are you living?
I'm living in a trailer.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm
glad you have a roof over your head.
Oh, thank you.
And
me too.
And I'm glad that you continue to fight for people who don't have roofs over their head. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to fill you in on a little juicy tidbit that I heard about you.
Oh, no.
From one of the city council members.
Oh, which one?
On a public bus. Rotkin.
Ah, Mike Rotkin, yes.
He said that, what did he say? He said that your parents set up a trust fund to pay you to stay out of San Francisco because they didn't like your work, and that they wanted you to stay away from them because you were being an activist for poor people, because you come from a pretty wealthy family, and they didn't like it, so they wanted to get rid of you, so they paid you to leave San Francisco. He said that on a public bus, and
he
I was wondering,
did.
Is it true?
Did you? No.
That's interesting that he can say that in public. Well, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, people will say any number of things. I mean,
so that's not true?
No. My folks and I have had our disagreements, but it hasn't been.
Are they wealthy?
No, but they're, you know, they're not poor.
Do they pay you to stay out of San Francisco?
No. They don't pay me to stay out of San Francisco.
They don't live in San Francisco?
I like, no.
Oh. Where do they live?
They live down south in the Monterey Peninsula area.
Do they pay you to stay out of there?
No. I visit them regularly. Actually, one of them's dead. I visit my dad regularly.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So no, that's a, you know, that's a fantasy of Mike's, and it's also.
I just thought I'd share it with you. You know.
Sure.
And I thought it was really interesting. You know, and I was kind of asking him questions that he didn't really like me to ask him. You know.
Mm-hmm.
On the bus, and so like, and then I brought you up because I know how he feels about you. You know, I just thought I'd, you know, Robert Norris, and then he just told me all this stuff, and I was like, wow.
Yeah, well, you know, people often, you know, color their facts with their feelings, and
definitely,
you know, Mike has never asked me anything. I guess maybe, well, you know, he's just he's a fellow who's a very endless apologist for the sleeping ban, and I'm afraid we're going to have him back next year.
Oh yeah, he's going to come back.
He's going to come back and run again. He's actually the person who's logged the most number of hours in the last 20 years as a city council member. He's been elected the most number of times. And,
sometimes, you know, I kind of feel like, you know, no one else wants to do it. And that's why we have these fucked up people in the office, because, you know, other people are too busy running after their Lexus or, you know, their cellular phones or whatever, you know, and they're not, like, really that interested in what's happening with the you know, the politics, as long as it's affecting them positively, as long as it gets the homeless people out of their face, then they don't have to worry about anything, and they can shop on Pacific Avenue Mall with their money and be all happy, so they don't really care what the city council are doing to people. Because they don't, you know, it doesn't matter to them. And if it helps them, they support the city council. And I think it kind of sucks. So I'm kind of glad that you're out there, Robert.
Well, hey, I'm glad you're out there, too.
Even though you're you're definitely sexist, and I think you should really work on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that knowing something about yourself that is something that has adversely affected another group of people throughout history is something that you should work on changing. And I'm actually doing the same thing because I have a problem with sexism towards men sometimes. I feel like women are better. And that's not
right
either. Well, that's not right to feel that way, because any group of person is no better than any other group of persons.
Well, maybe.
It's all about individuals, I think.
Well, it's certainly about individuals. On the other hand, if a group comports themselves a certain way, Germans might not be bad people, but if they during the Second World War, they certainly, maybe Americans did too, acted in a fashion that, I guess, Americans.
Well, totally, Americans did. Dude, they bombed fucking Hiroshima.
Yeah, I know.
And not all Germans, and not all Americans.
Right.
There's always us fucking down there saying, fuck you, Mike Rotkin! Fuck you, FCC!
There you go, and down with the Fuhrer and all that sort of thing.
Totally. Hey, I'm going to let you keep going on your show. You're doing a great job.
Hey, thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And, of course, we should have asked Earth Mommer where and when her show is, because if you want to hear more about her thoughts on other subjects, that's when you can tune into Free Radio and hear her. I'm looking for the schedule, and it's over on the wall. But, of course, if I go there, you won't be able to hear me. So perhaps later in the show, I'll try to give the times for her show if you want to tune in on her show. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pier Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. And actually, a subject you've heard me babble on endlessly and appropriately about the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban. The section of Municipal Code 6.36.010, the A section, that's the sleeping ban, which makes it illegal to sleep in any non-domicile. That is to say, in a theater, in a garage, in a church, all these places it's illegal to sleep at night in Santa Cruz after 11 o'clock. It's also illegal to sleep in a vehicle, under a vehicle, or outside. And it gives the police a blank check to harass people whenever they want after during those. Actually, it's not even between 11 and 8:30 is when the sleeping ban is in force. But there is a third section, the encampment section, which is a section used against Camp Paradise and those who have camps or don't, which is applicable 24 hours a day and says if you are camping, if you have set up a campsite with the intention of sleeping overnight, you can be charged at any time of the day or night. And that means anybody. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a fire and a barbecue pit and a generator going in the back and a big tent. No, it just means that the cop just has to decide to write the little word 6.36010C on the ticket. Because believe me, in the history of the police department here in Santa Cruz, of all the bogus camping and sleeping ban tickets written by the police, I don't know that there's ever been disciplinary action for a police officer once on this subject. Now, some of this is secret, so I wouldn't know about it, but you would think that somewhere along the line I would have heard about some kind of checks on these abuses which the police department do. And unfortunately, I haven't heard of that. I know we do have a poodle, toy poodle, kind of yap yap Citizens Police rah-rah board, or rubber stamping board as I call it. They call themselves the Citizens Police Review Board. And, you know, you can squeeze a few interesting pieces of information out of that board, but never any meaningful checks on police misconduct. That's the problem. And you get people who are starry-eyed idealists like Becky Blythe, or former idealists and now full-time politicos like Sandy Brown, who have positions on this board, although Brown has reached the point where she's had so many absentee moments there, so many absences, that she really they sent a letter to the mayor saying she's really screwed up. And, of course, I knew that 2 years ago. She was another one of those people who we had a lot of hope in, as some of us had hope in the council members. I wasn't terribly hopeful, but, you know, you like to not necessarily assume people are lying when they open their mouths in political campaigns, which is probably a mistake. It's probably good to assume they're lying and then look at their past history and say, that's really where we tell, not what you say now, but what you've done before and what you will be continuing to do is really the likely litmus test of what's going to happen. Citizens Police Review Board is occasionally okay in the sense that it occasionally gives us some information. For example, it's very instructive to compare the cases in 1999 of the many folks, or the five people who were arrested and many others who were dispersed by police in May of 1999 in front of the Front Street McPherson Center on the occasion of the protest against the bombing of Yugoslavia, when Representative Farr was there having his little black tie affair. And this is the same guy who supports uranium depleted weapons and supports cluster bombs, and I keep hearing, oh, but he's a wonderful guy on these other issues. And that's true, I suppose. You know, I mean, there are some issues that he's done some good things on, but nothing, for example, around homelessness, nothing around police abuse. The issues that I'm really kind of concerned with, and I've actually talked to him about, he's done absolutely nothing about that I'm aware of. So it's a real sad thing. Also, I knew Farr. I knew Farr when he was a youth down. He comes from the Monterey Bay Area where I grew up, and I actually knew him. And I knew his father, who was also a politician, and they were, you know, they have the label Liberal Democrats in front of their names, but, you know, look at Willie Brown. There's their Liberal Democratic mayor of San Francisco. and you get the same crap. I mean, look at Green Party Mayor Fitzmaurice. I mean, there's someone who's supposed to be the left of the Democrats, and what has he done? He won't even allow the sleeping ban to be discussed at City Council. His own Green Party is slowly coming to understand this, that it's not just me, you know, defaming a good, gentle instructor of English up at the university, but it's the actual truth. It's just how it is. That this guy is more beholden to Marty Wormhout and John Laird and Catherine Byers and Mike Rotkin and the sort of the small elite circle of politicians who run the town than to the principles that he supposedly enunciated when he ran for office, and he did enunciate and supposedly follows and believes in 1998 when he was elected as part of a slate of people who were supposed to make changes and didn't. So the changes that are going to get made are, we're going to be the ones that are going to make them, I'm afraid. You, me, and the person next to you that you haven't met. And that's really the deal. It's not going to happen until we do it. And that's why I like to see associations forming of homeless people, of renters, of elderly people, women, students, you name it. You know, gay folks, Latinos, people, you know, who are concerned with their own basic rights and asserting their own interests, because it's not going to happen otherwise. And asserting your own interests, by the way, is not a bad and selfish thing to do, particularly if you're poor. It is a vital thing to do, and it also is a natural thing to do. And it's when you're not asserting your interests, you know, I mean, it's also it makes you a trustworthy person. People look at you and they say, this is what he's doing, these are his interests, that's what she or he is asserting. And you can be understood because you do that. If you simply sort of are following an ideology, that's a little more untrustworthy. You know, that's different. Although I guess maybe in a certain extent I do follow an ideology myself. Maybe contradictorily enough, I believe in civil rights for all people, and there are lots of civil wrongs going on here in Santa Cruz. Now, the sleeping ban, as I said, and the camping ban are two laws that are the camping ordinance includes both these sections, the sleeping ban, the blanket ban, and the camping ban. And it's an important, but not the only, restriction on criminalization on homeless people, because it's so frequently comes up every night when you have to sleep. I mean, you may only come downtown and sit on the mall a couple times a day, so the sitting ban doesn't come up as much. There's a ban against sitting within 10 feet of a store, within 50 feet of an ATM, within 4 feet of a drinking fountain or a phone booth, and essentially on any structure so not intended, quote-unquote, for such a purpose, which police then use to move along people they don't like. These things don't come up as frequently, but sleeping comes up all the time, and it's a life-sustaining deal. And that's why it is such an obvious deal, and that's why you really can get a pretty good barometer of the moral health of the community and the moral nature or the immoral nature of the central political structure by seeing how poor people are treated. It's like, I don't know if it was Oscar Wilde who said, if you want to see the core of a society is, check out its jails and see how they treat their prisoners, and that'll tell you about the society. And actually, it sounds true to me, but I've never investigated whether there is significant difference in the way societies treat their prisoners, and so I haven't really got a basis for judging that statement, but it sounded good when I heard it. Anyway, sleeping is essential, and it seems like a basic thing, which for years I've been fighting for the right for people to sleep somewhere. Not everywhere, not anywhere, but somewhere. So, and of course, you get Rotkin and other political hacks and political revolving door candidates who keep coming back, who do it very well, who misrepresent this position and, you know, come up with all kinds of paranoid fantasies about everybody coming to Santa Cruz to sleep on the wonderful sidewalks, and all Santa Cruz is getting very selfish and mean to homeless people afterward because they see all these nasty new homeless people, and therefore they won't give the old ones any more social services. This is the kind of fables and fabrications that Rotkin spins, and that other council members do too, although it has to be said that when the task force to examine the camping ordinance came together in 1998 in the winter, that was Catherine Byers' sort of sop to the people that elected the new three council members, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar. Instead of changing the law, she set up this task force to study the law. And one of the things they found was there's no magnet effect. in the cities that have abandoned their sleeping bans, that people don't come to town in great measures, that the social services do not report a big increase, or any increase per se, so that's just bullshit. I mean, that's just not true. The stuff that they say, oh, you know, you lift the sleeping ban, then everybody's going to sleep in your backyard. And actually, fewer people will sleep in your backyard because there'll be, you know, legal places for them to sleep elsewhere. Not, and it's never legal to sleep in someone's backyard without their permission anyway. So where the hell did that come from? You know, I mean, it came from people wanting to maintain the existing laws and lie about what the situation would be and what the situation is. I mean, it's really sad that people that you think they speak so well and they speak so charmingly and they can juggle this and juggle that like Mike Rodkin can, and oh, I don't know, people like Ed Porter, who's now in power and said he opposed the sleeping ban, he was going to act on it immediately, or if not sooner. We haven't heard a peep out of him publicly, you know? The guy is, you know, they don't. Some sort of darkness descends on them once they're in power. But it's not just the sleeping ban and the camping ban. It is a series of laws that criminalize homeless people for what's called life-sustaining behaviors. That has to do with lighting a fire on a cold night, sleeping in a park, even if it's closed, taking a piss if the public restrooms are closed outside. It has to do with lying down on a piece of public property like a bench when they haven't got anywhere else to lie down, really. These are things that should not be, and for example, are not criminal behavior in at least one major city in this country, and that is Miami, Florida. In Miami, Florida, after the police were engaging in egregious attempts to drive homeless people out of town, similar to what the Santa Cruz police did in the 1970s, the federal court stepped in with the assistance of the ACLU. Unlike our ACLU, our people, Bob Tarrant, Isabel Gilman, who don't do anything here around homeless civil rights issues and haven't for years. I think there was a brief deal about the sitting ban, but, you know, generally they're horrible on homeless rights issues. The ACLU in Miami took up the cause, and they won a significant victory in 1992 in the so-called Pottinger decision, which I've mentioned before on this show. And their victory was ratified in 1998 by a huge settlement with the city of Miami and the police department, in which certain guidelines were put in play. And those guidelines simply, in the main, they provided for training for police officers. They provided the police officers have to fill out incident reports. Whenever they have any kind of contact with a homeless person involving any kind of so-called homeless crime, sleeping, pissing, shitting, sitting, in a forbidden area like here in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to be on the riverbanks after dark. In fact, the entire camp, I guess, I'm not sure, I guess Camp Paradise is not in that zone. Or maybe it is. I actually got to check that. In 1997-98, Catherine Byers passed a law which made it illegal for a person to be on the levee after dark, even if you're standing there with your lover staring at the sunset, or staring at the stars, actually, or walking along the levee, you know, listening to the river. That's illegal any time after dark. Currently, it is illegal, punishable by a fine of $162. Second offense, misdemeanor, that up to $1,000 fine and 6 months in jail. So that's pretty crazy, but that's the kind of mentality. Now, if in Miami, Florida, in areas where parks are closed at night, for example, you cannot charge a homeless person with that kind of crime. You cannot charge a homeless person with sleeping. You cannot charge a homeless person with defecating or urinating in public unless you can come up to that person, if you're the police officer, and offer her or him a shelter bed for the night. If you can do that, then you can tell that person, I'm offering you a bed. If you don't accept it, I'll charge you with this crime. Then you can do that. So it gives the police, it's certainly liable to police abuse. However, it is a damn sight better than the situation we have in Santa Cruz, where there's this blank check for police to run around grilling homeless people at will, patting them down for this and that, looking in their pockets, searching them illegally, interrogating them, and telling them to move to nowhere or get out of town, which happens regularly still in our community. So the Pottinger decision in Miami was a very important thing, and frankly, it was also quite unique. I haven't heard of it happening in any other city quite this way. And the Pottinger guidelines are quite impressive. And I think I read them over the air once. I'm going to read them again. What I did was, though, I wanted to find out what had happened since 1998 in Miami and wanted to get some conversation with one of the attorneys who helped fight the Pottinger case. He actually wasn't around in the original, in the early 90s, when this case was sort of really brewing, but he came on board later. His name is Rosenberg, Arthur Rosenberg, and I was able to reach him this morning and do an interview with him, and I'm going to play that interview now, and I hope it's kind of enlightening. He didn't give me as much information as I'd hoped in some respects, but it's still worth the listening, and I encourage you to listen to it. Call in if you have any thoughts. We're going to try to play the whole interview first, but if you really got something you need to say beforehand, we'll take your call, and we'll take it off air, and we can maybe bring it on air. Call in number is 427-3772, and you're tuned to 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz.
August 29th, 2001. It's about 10 to 8 in the morning. Called Arthur Rosenberg of Miami, Florida, an ACLU attorney.
Actually, what we have to do is wait a bit because the tape involves setting up the call. I'm going to do that. Rosenberg is not actually an ACLU attorney. He is a private attorney, I guess, who got involved with this. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union in Miami, is involved with the homeless civil rights situation in Miami. And I'm kind of stalling for time here while we get this tape queued up properly. He's a very approachable fellow. He was willing to talk, and he called me back several times. And everything he said is his own opinion.
I'm good.
And what you hear is a little preliminary conversation as the two of us sort of set up the phone call. It's really impressive that a large city, which is not particularly friendly in my mind, I don't think Miami, you know, this in Florida, you have a situation where the election was supposedly stolen, and you don't really normally think of Florida as a liberal area, a liberal state, or Miami as a liberal city, but it's more liberal than Santa Cruz in terms of how it treats homeless people.
Our position was to set up the safe zone. The court basically ruled that the actions of the police prior to 1992, which was to arrest people for violating what has later become life-sustaining misdemeanors, which is sleeping in the park after hours, urinating in public, disrobing in order to take a bath or a shower or something in the, whether it be the river or a fountain, that those kinds of behaviors could not be criminalized if a person didn't have a place to go, if there weren't shelter space available. And so in the interim, what the court did was, until such shelter space is available, that homeless people in the city of Miami had to have some place to go, had to be able to go someplace, and they should be able to do these kinds of things. And so he described it as safe zones, so that, and this was intended to be a temporary measure until such more permanent facilities could be arranged.
Mm-hmm. And in essence, those safe zones, do they actually operate for 6 years, or?
No, actually they really operated for a much shorter period of time than that. It was maybe a couple of years that they operated, and then eventually they started disappearing because a new homeless shelter got online. And basically, the safe zones were not a place that anybody really wanted. It was, an attempt to try to redress the temporary situation where there wasn't enough shelter space, but it wasn't that even we liked the safe zones, and many of the homeless people didn't like the safe zones.
What were the safe zones?
There were two, basically, encampments that were designated safe zones. One was under highway, and the other was in a park. And, they were not really that great. There was a bunch of crime going on. I don't think many homeless people really felt that safe in them. But they were safe from the police.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they couldn't be arrested for anything, I mean, other than for violent crimes and felonies and various arrests that anyone would be subject to. They were not arrested for any kind of homeless-related activity. And what I mean by that is there's like a list of...
Right, camping in parks, littering,
exactly,
loitering in a restaurant.
That, you know, you want the homeless people just sort of tend to do just because of their lives on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Now, were these areas primarily used by homeless people, or were they essentially sort of the pro forma areas designated by the city because they were ordered to do so by the court so that they could maintain, oh, I don't know, other areas in the city and pristine and free of homeless people, and they could continue to enforce those anti-homeless laws?
Well, okay. These were areas that homeless people were sort of living in anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they became sort of formalized.
Mm-hmm. How big were they? City block each, or... I don't know, by the way, is an acceptable answer if you don't know.
You know, they were, you know, at one point there were probably about 200 people in each. This is a real, real rough guess. You know, one ran under a highway, so it was kind of a long and narrow strip.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would say maybe the size of a football field.
And are those zones now considered closed, or are they?
There are no present encampments like that. The safe zones don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That is correct.
People don't sleep there anymore, or?
If they do, it's one or two. I mean, it's not considered an area that homeless people go to.
Why is that?
That's not to say there are not homeless people. But basically, the large encampments in the city of Miami no longer exist.
Did the city essentially move in to disperse them? Did other developments happen? What essentially?
Well, what happened was, as the homeless shelter got online, there was actually an effort by the city, and what all came about, Robert, actually, all this sort of started happening at the same time. After the decision by Judge Atkins, and right around that time, the people down here in charge and a group of community leaders got together, and they started, and the governor actually had appointed a task force to take a look at what the problem was, to try to set something up. The mayor of the county that Miami sits in got involved, and there was a development of a homeless task force and then a homeless trust. The homeless trust actually still exists. I say, what do we do about dealing with the problem? And involved in there, and I mean, I'm not going to say that any one thing triggered all of this, but Pottinger obviously played a significant role, and that is the passing of a tax. This is a long roundabout answer, but the passing of a tax, a food and beverage tax of half a penny.
Which makes about how much a year, would you estimate?
It's bringing in about $600,000 a year.
And just briefly, the homeless population you estimate in the greater Miami area is... realizing it's a ballpark figure.
6,000.
Okay.
I'm just using that as a rough estimate.
But only 200 of those were using these safe areas anyway, so I guess most were not in the safe areas.
Well, that was one safe area that had about 200. There was a second. There were two safe areas. There were probably, I'm going to guess, 500 people.
And so most folks were outside the safe areas.
Yeah.
And were they, in essence, during that period of time, outside police protection, or were they protected by the Pottinger guidelines?
They were still protected by the Pottinger guidelines.
And did they actually work? In other words, were the police, did you get a lot of cases of people who complained they were still being arrested or harassed for these kinds of behaviors?
Not after the decision was rendered.
Not after 1992?
Not, right, especially right after.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the police were very, very aware of what was going on. It sort of sent a very strong signal in this community that they were really being paid attention to.
Did it result in the opening of public restrooms? I would imagine if you can't arrest someone for taking a piss on the sidewalk, you'd want them to be able to have access to a restroom.
No. I mean, yes, you would think that would happen, but we don't have very many public restrooms here. And the move here was not to open up public restrooms and make life on the street better for homeless people. The effort was through the tax, through this trust, was to put up more shelter beds.
Now, the number of shelter beds, we spoke about this earlier, is no more than 750, right, total?
It could be as much as 1,000.
Uh-huh.
There are not enough shelter beds to match the number of people who are homeless. On the other hand, there are a number of shelter beds. Whether it's enough, I don't know, and I'm not even sure whether we would advocate that there should be more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's what the needs are. I'm not sure that's where the money should be going.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another issue. But the shelter beds were online, and going back to the issue of the closing down of the safe zones, as the beds got online at the Homeless Assistance Center, the new one in downtown Miami was built, there was outreach efforts made by the county and the city to go out and try to place every single person who wanted to be placed from the safe zones, so that there was a team of outreach workers. They'd go out, meet with people, say they're going to be coming out at certain times, and then they would try to place them in appropriate places or...
But again, this was kind of a drop in the bucket, right? The safe zones contain less than 1/5 of the homeless population in Miami, correct?
That's correct.
So, but the rest, the other 4/5, you think are in better shape as far as police go, that they are being respected in terms of where they have to sleep?
Yes. I mean, I think they're much better off than they were 10 years ago, and I think they're much better off before the Potter decision, yes.
You and I talked about the question of, and I guess we had a difference, I initially had thought that the action by the judge, that by Clyde Adkins, that produced this essentially legalization of public homelessness, produced a more visible homeless population that resulted in, you know, kind of a scare among merchants that their tourists would be driven away, and so they wanted to suddenly put up a lot of services to get them out of sight. This is what I heard happened in Fort Lauderdale, but that's not what happened in Miami.
Can you say that again?
Well, the idea that you couldn't use the police to disperse the visible homeless.
Right.
Alarmed merchants who were concerned fundamentally and practically with not having folks who were less... visibly attractive to tourists in public places. They wanted rid of them. And so to get rid of them, you had to, in essence, you know, fund some kind of shelter, and they did.
I think that's absolutely correct, and that's what happened here in Miami.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the lines in the Pottinger decision by Judge Atkins was, you know, you can't arrest people for being out on the street and being in parks, this is just paraphrasing, if they have no place to go. If they have no other place to sleep, and there's no other place available, how can you arrest someone? And it violates the Constitution to arrest them for sleeping in a public place.
Here in Santa Cruz, for instance, we have the argument from some council members, like a fellow named Mike Rodkin, who bills himself as a socialist. He's no longer a council member, but he probably will be again in a year and a half, that if, you know, homeless people were able, and their advocates, to overturn the city's law against sleeping, which it's currently criminal to sleep outdoors in a vehicle or on much private property, Santa Cruz is a very draconian sleeping ban, that this would result in homeless people coming from all over the place, a magnet effect. Was there a magnet effect as a consequence of the Pottinger decision? Did social services report a big increase in the number of homeless people coming to town?
No. I mean, that's never been noted. I mean, if there was any increase, it's never been documented, to my knowledge. We have not seen... you know, it's never been advertised anywhere that Miami is the greatest place for homeless people, and I mean, homeless people came here for various reasons, and people came here because they were looking for jobs, or they were looking for whatever it is that Miami has to offer, and then they ended up homeless. That's more than likely the case scenario. People who were outside of Miami did not come here because this was a great place.
Mm-hmm. So. The second thing that's often raised is, second consideration is that, we talked about this a moment ago, that if you do decriminalize different aspects of homelessness, it will result in a backlash in the community, and there will be a cut in social services. And in fact, I guess I've been suggesting, and you seem to have been confirming, that the opposite is the case, that they actually increase social services once the magnitude of the homeless situation becomes visible.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there was an increase in services, and I think one of the reasons is that as a result of the court decision, there's been, and as a result of sort of the trust in the homeless task force that was set up down here, people recognize something's just got to be done. I mean, you can't, this whether the businesses don't like it, people don't, you know, businesses did not like homeless people sleeping on the, you know, in the front steps and urinating in front of their businesses, and, you know, all the typical things that are complained about by business and the civic members of the community. They didn't like it. They wanted to do something about it, and I think they all realized that criminalization, and I think that's one of the underpinnings of Pottinger, and one of the strongest things is that criminalization is not the way to deal with homelessness, and that obviously if there is criminal behavior on the part of anybody, whether they be homeless or not homeless, you deal with that criminally. But for just being homeless, criminalization is not the way to go unless you have some alternatives. And in the case in Miami, is if there is an alternative and there is a bed available and a person still refuses and says, look, I don't want to go to the alternatives, I don't want to go to the shelter, I'd rather sleep in the park, I'd rather sleep on the street. At that point, the court permits the police to do something about it because they are still violating the law, it's just that they have an alternative. If you are poor, so poor that you have no place to go, you can't be, that can't be criminalized.
Have other jurisdictions, such as, well, I know that Austin, Texas overturned its sleeping ban last year, and Portland, Oregon overturned its entire camping ban last year, although I understand they're still harassing homeless, at least in Portland, probably in Austin. Have they come to you, homeless advocates from other cities, requesting information on how the Pottinger guidelines are working? Have you seen that there's, you know, an interest in expanding these guidelines to other jurisdictions, and have federal courts anywhere else? I haven't heard that they've been sympathetic. In fact, quite the contrary, I've heard, you know, that there's been bad precedent set in San Francisco and Seattle. What's your sense about the impact of the Pottinger decision nationally and its future as a kind of a model?
Well, I'm really hopeful that it remains a model, but I can't say that any other courts have said this is the only way to go. It has not been followed. It has been recognized, but it has not been followed. I mean, it's not like wildfire spreading around the country, let me tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
It still remains a very unique decision, and the outcome of the decision and what happened down here in Miami over the last 8 to 10 years has not necessarily been replicated. I think a lot of cities have taken parts of it. I know, you know, that Fort Lauderdale has, you know, the training aspect. They're much more concerned about training, and they've kind of followed the Pottinger model and, you know, changed it accordingly, but they've kind of followed that model.
They're pretty close. They're, you know, they're afraid that Atkins, while he was alive, could have applied it to them, right?
Right. But and then they've taken it on, and I think, you know, and I think people have really kind of, both in Fort Lauderdale and Miami, I think they've taken it on and realized that this is a much better way to go, to provide services, give people a chance to improve themselves, give people a chance to get some services, and get them out of homelessness that way rather than criminalizing them. Part of it is, I think, the jail system realized that, you know, homeless people are just filled up in jails. I know judges were very pleased about this because they hated the idea of just having someone come before them and then they're going to say, okay, time served, 2 days, get out of here, and then they see him 2 days later.
Mm-hmm. Any stats on numbers of homeless people in jail under these so-called crimes, life-sustaining misdemeanors, prior to the Pottinger decision and, let's say, now?
I know we had numbers of it prior. I don't know what they are now. They're not. I mean, what I've seen not too long ago is, you know, they've cut down drastically. But I just can't tell you. I mean, I know that, you know, we've spent time going through, and one of the requirements of the settlement is that the police need to fill out field identification cards, which are cards for every contact with a homeless person to state, you know, was the person arrested, were they warned, what was the circumstances, and we've gone through a number of months to kind of get a gauge on what's going on, and, you know, there's not 100% compliance. I can be quite honest about that. But there is a significant number of cards that are filled out. Now, does this necessarily mean they're perfectly accurate? No, but...
How many stops are there per month have you found in your...
Well, they're not stops. They're contacts. which could be stops or could be various other things. I mean,
how many contacts?
Oh, hundreds.
How does that compare with the number of times that people were contacted prior to the...
I don't know because the contacts, there are very different kinds of contacts. The contacts prior to Hunter were basically, we're doing a sweep of the park and we're going to arrest you. You know, they really didn't care too much about homeless people for giving them services, whereas now they're much more, the steps include the provision of services, and offering of services.
How many complaints a month do you receive that police are not following the Pottinger guidelines?
A few. I mean, a month, I hardly receive any. There are a couple that come in every so often where we'll get one from the ACLU who I cooperated with. I was cooperating with the attorney. I don't work for the ACLU. And you know, we get a couple here and there.
And what's the recourse? What do you do when such a complaint comes in?
Basically, we refer them to the
three-person committee.
There's a three-person advisory committee, the Pottinger Advisory Committee. It was set up. It's three people. It's an appointee of the ACLU, an appointee of the state department.
Is that funded? Who funds that?
It's funded by the city.
Going back a bit, who was Pottinger and how did this case arise? Do you have any sense, kind of a quick thumbnail sketch of that?
The case arose, I was not party to it at the time. It sort of started back in the 88, 89, when basically what was happening is the police were going into mostly parks, 6 o'clock in the morning, and sort of basically rousting homeless people, destroying their property, burning their property, and arresting them. And they would do this on a fairly regular basis. It was called the Bump Squad. And there was that, and then whenever there was any kind of event, a tourist-type event, whether one was the Pope who came into town, another was the Orange Bowl, you know, the Orange Bowl happens here every year, prior to any kind of event in which the city is intending to make the place look nice, kind of to make homeless people look invisible, they would have sweeps. Not to say there weren't sweeps going on all the time, but they were basically upgraded. It's like, you got company coming, we're going to really clean the house. And as a result of that, and continual raids on parks, and arrests for just sleeping in the park, basically, it led to this lawsuit. And Michael Pottinger was just one of the people who was arrested.
What's happened to him, do you know?
Michael, I haven't heard from him recently. He's doing pretty well here in Miami.
All right, well, we have on the air, breaking in with this interview with Arthur Rosenberg of Miami, a man in jail. That's Jim Costner. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Robert. Hello, Sir Nate. It looks like they're going to lock us down, so I don't have a... That's the way it goes.
Oh, any quick messages to us?
Just that Big Mountain is under attack again, and for the first time since 1997, the traditional elders are calling for supporters and people to go to the land. And I guess there were 7 elders arrested, and supporters were arrested just about a week ago, and they cut down the traditional ceremony tree, so they basically violated the ceremonial rights of the Diné, and they are basically trying to close down the elders from having their traditional gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
For the first time since 1997, they're calling for people to go to the land and wanting to encourage people to support the Diné resistance. And
what's happening with your trial? When do you go to?
Actually, I guess it's the 15th in LA. There's going to be a huge Momia rally down in LA, and there'll be carpooling. So you can call the local coalition for that, which is 425-4467. And I have a trial on the 14th here in San Jose. Last 2 to 3 days. And I just lost my lawyer today, so things are getting a little hard, but still got to proceed, and I got to go because the man is telling me to get off the phone. So before I get more infracted and more in trouble, I better go.
All right. Thank you, Jim.
Great interview, and thanks for taking the call, Robert.
All right. And that was activist Jim Costner in jail awaiting trial for smashing with a sledgehammer the statue of Christopher Columbus, the esteemed mass murderer and conquistador. I guess he did it back in April, March or April of this year, and he's been in jail on and off ever since in a series of peculiar court maneuvers, which we followed to some extent on my show. He raised the bail, but they did a sneaky process by which they raised the same charges through a different means by using a grand jury indictment. So he had to raise a second bail, and he couldn't do that, and so now he is in jail awaiting trial on September 14th, I guess it is. And what I understand, his attorney, Larry Hildes, is not going to be able to represent him and couldn't get a continuance from the judge. He had hoped he could, but Larry is Jewish, and his the court date falls on a Jewish holiday, and also so he's going to be with his family. And then in the second instance, he's going to be doing trials in Idaho for the next couple of weeks, and that will give him no time to prepare for Jim's case. So he's not available, and Jim is going to defend himself in court and try to explain to a jury of 12 people why he should not be held guilty of felony vandalism for smashing a statue of Christopher Columbus with a sledgehammer. It's going to be a difficult argument to make, but of course, if he can convince one juror that Columbus was sufficiently odious to the community, to the Latino community, and Jim has some, I believe, Latino ancestry as well as ancestry from other native sources, possibly he can get a hung jury, and that would be the option to get prepare for another trial with more time. It's also hard to prepare for trial when you're in jail, as Jim has pointed out. If you want more information about this, you can call the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I've got some information about Jim's situation, and I've been putting it out, but you certainly can write to him if you want in jail and give a call to 423-HUFF if you want his address. And you have to be very careful about what you put on the envelope in terms of the right numbers. My letter to Jim came back because I didn't do it appropriately, so it's a sort of a very bureaucratic, officious sort of system that you have to get communications through there. It's not good. Of course, I never thought Jim should run around smashing Columbus statues anyway without a support group, and the way he did. He's sort of a man who goes off on his own and does his own thing. Once it was done, however, I felt that it was important to be supportive, and to the extent that I can, I am. And I encourage others to be as well. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm your host, Bathrobe's Peer Robert Norse, without a bathrobe, but certainly coming at you in the nighttime when it's getting to be sleepy time and everyone's going to have to go beddy-bye pretty soon. But if you're outside, that's a $54 fine, or you have to worry about getting hassled or moved along or having your privacy suddenly invaded after 11 o'clock at night.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I have another question for you.
My goodness, it's the persistent caller.
It's the caller.
Go ahead, caller.
It's the caller with the evil V-Man in the background.
Oh, no, V-Man. Arrest that guy.
Hooray!
He's already arrested, I know.
Yeah, yes.
Don't you have to go to the bank to pick up your junk bond?
Hey, man. my junk bond, yes. I thought we don't talk about that on the air.
Hey, yes, private. You, mister? Yeah.
So what is your question, caller?
My question for me is a question. I wanted to know if you can help people find housing that are homeless and,
no.
Like, what... No, you can't.
Other than Camp Paradise, you know, where people can go.
Right.
You know, which has both its drawbacks and its advantages.
Okay, here comes the baby.
Oh, okay.
Hi.
Hi there, baby.
Hey.
Don't accuse me of being sexist
Hi.
Just because I said baby. Hi, baby.
Free radio.
Hey there. So, how's your mom treating you?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to get back to the show now, caller, unless you have another question.
That was it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And actually, there are the ways to get housing, of course. The ways to lose housing seem to be more multifarious than the ways that you get it. I just heard today from a friend about a man she knows who now is homeless and lives in his vehicle because even though he'd previously been making a pretty good salary, he lost that job, some sort of computer deal job, and then he got into a deal where he agreed to do some work and to live in a barn, and also to start paying for the barn, or paying for a trailer, I guess, out of the barn, and got into a fight with the disagreement with his boss, and of course the whole thing fell apart. Where do you get housing? Well, you know, there's some transitional programs in the community where you can, I don't know, you get on the SLIC list, and, you know, Section 8 housing, there is some, but the list is very long. If Linda LeMaster, who's the co-chair of Housing Now here in Santa Cruz, were listening, she could probably give us some more details, but I understand she's listening to a Voices from the Village show on Parkinson's, which is on even as we speak on Channel 27, for those of you who are well-heeled enough to have cable. That's Channel 27. It's Charlie Phillips' Voices from the Village show. Everyone welcome in the studio except myself and Becky Johnson. But that's neither here nor there. If you want more information about housing, give a call to Linda LeMaster, and she may set you into some references as to, you know, who. I mean, Community Action Board is concerned about shelter and housing. That's 457-1741. But I'm not. It's a long shot to say that they can get you housing. I don't think so. But they might give you some indication of where you might begin to start looking, other than the want ads or under a bridge or Camp Paradise. And I was quite serious when I said Camp Paradise. But Linda LeMaster's number is 423-HOME, 423-H-O-M-E, which is 4663, and that's how you get housing now. Just leave her a message that you're interested, and eventually she'll get back to you. She's got a lot of disabilities, so she does take some time to do it occasionally, but, you know, she will, and is eventually get back to you, at least I hope she will. Right now, however, we are on Free Radio Santa Cruz, or you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, the pirate station, matey. That's the station without a license from the FCC, and proud of it. We put out useful information to the community. We don't hurt anybody else's signal. We don't bring down airplanes with our signal. We don't cause consternation. We educate, we agitate, and hopefully, although it's not too clear this actually happens, we organize. So give a call to 423-427-3772 to be a part of the show. We still have half an hour to go. I'm going to play you now the last part of the interview with Arthur Rosenberg, which we interrupted because we got a call from jail from Jim Costner, and we couldn't really give him the interview that he would have liked to have because they were locking him down. Well, Pottinger is the case that said to the Miami police, you can no longer arrest homeless people for life-sustaining misdemeanors, such as camping and sleeping, unless you have shelter bed to offer them and they refuse it, which I think is a fine guideline to set up in Santa Cruz. It does put people in a position where they have to take this access to what may be a shitty shelter system, but since there's so few shelters anyway, the real impact would be for most people they would have to be left alone more by the police. And also there's the additional aspect that homeless people got financial compensation or restitution for what was the property and the civil rights that were stolen from them in massive police expeditions of the early 90s and late 80s in Miami, which we also need here. Restitution. That's not really talked about a lot, but it's important. You know, when you're treated like less than a human being regularly and repeatedly, you should get some kind of damages. And also that acts as a deterrent to the police department in terms of doing those kinds of depredatory expeditions in the future. So I think that's not a bad thing to try and do. So let's hear the rest of the Pottinger interview. I should say the Rosenberg interview. This is Arthur Rosenberg, attorney in Miami.
Well, mine went through the Homeless Assistance Center and was placed somewhere, and I don't actually know where he is at the moment.
Recently I've been speaking to Santa Barbara activists who are concerned about a disappearance of SROs, single-room occupancy, and, of course, the huge escalation in rents that we have here on the West Coast that, you know, makes essentially affordable living for many people who are on fixed incomes a car, living in a vehicle of some kind. What's the situation look like in Miami in terms of rents for you, and has much new housing been built in the last 10 years as a function of this Pottinger decision, in your view?
Well, as a result of Pottinger, again, when I say as a result of Pottinger, a variety of factors, including Pottinger, came together in the early 90s here in Miami, which led to the passing of this tax, a creation of a public-private partnership, and I'm not necessarily here to tout that as the be-all and end-all, but lots of money came into the city of Miami and to Dade County to fund homelessness. We got lots of money from HUD, well over $100 million over a span of a few years that went into, transitional programs and also permanent housing. And a number of buildings, capital construction went underway, and a bunch of rehabs to put people into programs and to make programs available, because it was recognized that just building a shelter, if you've got a continuum of care and you've got lots of shelter beds, and it's time for them to leave the shelter.
What's the vacancy rate in Miami?
I have no idea.
And you don't have rent control?
No. I mean, what happened here is that every other city is the sort of SROs, the sort of marginal rooming houses, a lot of them were destroyed for urban renewal. That's where all the homeless, and as a result of that, people who were living in these marginal places became
urban homeless. Renewal for the rich without replacement for those who had previously been using the low-income facilities, right?
Well, no, not necessarily for the rich, but just for businesses, for parking, for, an arena, whatever it may be.
Well, those who already have homes, let's put it that way.
I'm sorry?
Those who already have homes.
Yes.
In other words, it's not for those who are living in hotels. It just destroys housing for those who are on the edge of homelessness, and it creates facilities for those who already are fairly well off.
I mean, to many people, it's just an eyesore. Let's get rid of it. That's what you do about urban renewal. Mm-hmm. And no one recognized, what's going to happen? I mean, these are not people that's going to go away. Of course, they didn't realize that these were people who work downtown. These are the people who are working at labor pools. These are the people who, had to be there, and they're not driving in their cars to come in to work at a labor pool.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be close to the labor pool. So nobody recognized that, and that led to an increase in homelessness, and there isn't much housing.
Any estimates of the increase in number of units for poor people in the last 10 years?
Has there been?
Any specific estimates as to how many there have been?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know there have been since the worst, since it really got destroyed. And most of it through development of homeless trust. But, when I say there's been an increase, we're not talking about thousands and thousands of units.
Mm-hmm. Miami has a population of about, you were telling me, 700,000 or a million, or how?
Well, the city itself probably has about 400,000 to 600,000
in the greater Miami area.
Oh, probably 2 million.
Because I was trying to get a comparative understanding. You were saying how many homeless people?
Yeah.
3,000, did you say?
Six.
6,000. Thank you.
But we have the county extends far into the southern part. We kind of go down towards the Keys, and in that area, and there's another homeless shelter, it's a whole other population. It's a very rural, agricultural population with many, many immigrants from Central America, and nobody has any idea how many homeless are there.
Uh-huh.
And there's been lots of, it's very rural, and it's, there's been bunches of estimates, but, that really aren't the problem.
In California, we've had problems with police shooting folks, or abusing homeless people physically, particularly killings of homeless people, whether it's in San Diego or here in Santa Cruz and in San Jose. I heard, from one of your workers there that a fellow named Beatty was a mentally ill homeless guy that was shot and killed by police recently.
Yeah.
Is that any less of a problem than it was 5 or 10 years ago?
I think we have a problem here in Miami with the police shooting people.
I've heard about that.
Period. I don't know that this was a homeless-related incident. It's a problem down here that we are trying to deal with, but I don't think it's a homeless-related.
Well, if you're homeless, you're more likely to run into the police. That's
correct.
The deal. So, and also, there's a sort of the middle-class hostility toward the homeless of, I don't want to say lifestyle, but life condition is such that, it's easy to blame homeless people, and I suspect, although some police officers don't, that some do, and that the flashpoint is there. Do you see a change in police behavior toward toward homeless people generally in terms of the likelihood of getting shot on the street by a police officer? I mean, that's, I guess that's my question.
I don't know the answer to that specifically, but what I can say is that I think there's much less harassment of homeless people. And if there's less harassment, I think in the long term there's going to be less violence. I think police in the city are aware. They lost the lawsuit. They paid out lots of money.
Police department or the city?
The city did.
Did the police lose any of that money, or were they simply just sort of going ho-hum about the whole thing?
I have no idea where the money came from. I know it came from the city, but, you know, the administration's not real happy with a big lawsuit and bad publicity, and they probably don't want to go through this again. Are the police, you know, have the police turned over a new leaf and said, yes, we love the homeless? I'm sure they don't. But I think there's a greater sensitivity. It hasn't, you know, Robert, it hasn't resolved all the problems. It hasn't, you know, made this a wonderful, you know, happy place where everybody lives together and there's no problems. I just think it has decreased the tension. It has decreased the harassment. I think the lives of homeless people are better now than it was before. It is a perfect, absolutely.
Do you have a Miami homeless paper there, I believe, or?
There was one for the city of Miami. Now there's one that actually comes out of Broward that is being sold down here, sort of especially in the northern part of the county, which is close to the Broward border.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of what the opinions of advocates are for homeless people who are, you know, closer to the street? Do they feel that Miami is a more homeless-friendly community or homeless-tolerant, if you will, community than it was? Or is there
any answer is it is yes, more homeless-tolerant than it was.
And that's also the feeling on the streets? In other words, I certainly know that's your opinion. I was wondering if you have any sense of maybe reading this paper or talking to homeless people, what their sense is.
Well, I mean, I talk to homeless people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I still do intake, and people at the homeless shelter, not as regularly as I did before, but I still do. You know, obviously when someone's being harassed or when someone runs into problems, they don't necessarily have the perspective of what it was like 10 years ago, because most of the people who are out on the streets now weren't homeless 10 years ago. I mean, it's not so much a stagnant population, so it's kind of hard to get that perspective, because life on the streets stinks, you know. No one's going to say, oh, well, it stinks, but it, you know, it's better than it was 10 years ago. I haven't gotten any answers like that. I mean, so I guess I use it. I answer this not because anybody has told me it's better than it was, but that's my sense based on the kinds of complaints and the types of complaints and the number of complaints.
Do you think a similar lawsuit would be successful in another jurisdiction in a federal court that produced the Pottinger guidelines? I'm sure that question's been asked you many times. Do you have any sense of that?
If you'd asked me that a number of years ago, I would have said, yeah, I think there's a real good chance of it being replicated. And now I really don't know. When I've seen the reactions of many, many courts of recognizing Pottinger, but not necessarily following it, I think it was just good timing. We had a great judge. The timing was just right. And I don't know if it would be replicated. I would be hard-pressed to say yes, but I think, and it would just be a matter of where the egregiousness and circumstance.
We've been talking to Arthur Rosenberg, an attorney in Miami, Florida, who has been closely involved with the Pottinger settlement, a settlement concerning the rights of homeless people to be free from police harassment in circumstances where they essentially have no other choice. I've been asking you lots of questions. Do you want to talk perhaps a little bit before we go about something, areas you think we've missed, or your sense about the significance of what's going on now? I mean, I guess the money has been dispersed. The homeless got a large money, a chunk of money. The attorney's got a huge chunk of money. And I guess there was this field intake cards are now required of police officers. What actually is there another step that is being taken on the Pottinger situation?
Well, actually, we're still distributing some of the money to homeless people. There was $1,500 awarded to each of the claimants, and the money that was left over is now being used and distributed to homeless families to get them off the streets and get them into housing, to provide them a first and last month's rent, things of that nature, so that homeless individuals and families can actually get into housing. So some of the money is being used for that, and that's close to the end, but we're finally getting the distribution. You know, there's the homeless committee, the advisory committee from the settlement, which is still overlooking things, and trying to monitor and make sure that the enforcement is still being implemented. If there are problems that arise, and making recommendations to the city and the ACLU for any changes. And in addition, there is police trainings that are going on, which require them to be trained in the of the Potter settlement and what the police protocol is, and to assure that police follow the protocol.
And any upsurge or drop in that what we call hate crimes against the homeless, shootings, beatings by vigilantes, we've been following that here, and it's been kind of depressing.
There has not been any upsurge at all. You know, it occurs every so often. You know, there's always an incident of a homeless man being beaten or something like that, and I, you know, but there has not been any particular upsurge, to my knowledge.
Santa Cruz has a community of homeless people called Camp Paradise, which are homeless individuals who've sort of gotten together, gotten clean and sober, and are essentially defying the law with the support of the community, our local law, which criminalizes any kind of camping or sleeping in Santa Cruz at night. They find that by being in a group, they are safer. Are groups of homeless people still allowed to camp and sleep, or are police running around with keeping a special supply of shelter beds open to break up such encampments?
There are not very many large encampments here in City Miami. There are a few little, you know, small groups. I don't know of them keeping open shelter beds. There are many instances where individuals are approached, and if there's no shelter bed, there's nothing that can be done about them, and I know that that's being complied with. Is it being complied with 100%? I can't say that.
I mean, what I'm saying is it's safer for homeless people to form small communities,
right.
And police may find this disagreeable, so what they can do is they know there's a stock of shelter beds, they avoid going to individuals who are sleeping, and they go to these communities that have formed and break them up by demanding that they go to the shelter beds. Does that happen?
I can't say that it does for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, the reality is the city and the police don't really want large groups of people. If anything, they want smaller groups and or individuals, if at all. And my guess is if there was a group of homeless people and they had a choice whether to make a number of stops to stop a few people from sleeping out in public if there are shelter beds available, or going to a group, I bet they would go to the group.
I think so too. I mean, I have no idea, but it would seem, yeah, that's...
I mean, I would do it. I could see them doing it, one, because the police don't want large groups, the city doesn't want large groups, and number two, it's easier, you get more people at one shot, and it's less work. So I think that makes logical sense. Robert, I'm going to have to...
Hey, you've overstayed your time, and I do appreciate...
And that was Arthur Rosenberg, who's attorney involved in the Pottinger versus City Miami case, which was actually a resounding victory for the homeless community there. Homeless people were paid restitution. Police now have to fill out contact cards every time they actually talk to a homeless person about a so-called homeless-style crime as a way that they can be monitored. It's sort of like the checks against racial profiling that some jurisdictions are now accepting, so that there's actually a record of how many times police stop a particular homeless, a homeless person who's homeless, just as there should be a record of the race of the person that's being stopped, so that we can see if police are engaging in inappropriate stops. And, of course, then there are the protocols that require police not to even approach homeless people for so-called life-sustaining misdemeanors like sleeping, camping, having a fire, being in a park after hour, public nudity, urinating or defecating, unless they have a shelter bed that they can offer. And that is almost a revolutionary kind of approach, although, you know, it's still, well, I mean, it's radically different than what's happening in other cities, and I really wanted to get a sense of how it was happening on the ground. And frankly, I was not as satisfied with that interview as I might have been, because I think Arthur knows how to talk his way around me, just like I could probably talk my way around him. But in terms of actual hard factual information and the viewpoint from the streets. We're going to have to talk to the people, possibly from the Miami Homeless Paper, and I'm going to try to get in touch with them in the weeks ahead, I believe. You're tuned to Free Radio, by the way, in case you've forgotten, 96.3 FM. This is your Free Radio, so give us a call at 427-3772 if you want to say anything about anything you've heard or you feel like you haven't been hearing enough relevant stuff around civil rights on the streets. Always be happy to take your thoughts on that. We're going to be hearing shortly from a caller who's tried twice to call in. I think he's going to give us an update on the Mumi Abu-Jamal case. That's the case of the Black Panther and reporter who's been held in jail for nearly 20 years now in a Philadelphia case and faces execution for allegedly shooting a police officer in a trial that has widely been condemned as fatally flawed, and indeed many believe him to be completely innocent. That's Mumi Abu-Jamal. And here is that call coming in.
Hi, you're on the air on Free Radio.
Yeah, Robert, this is John.
Hey, John.
With the Santa Cruz Coalition to Free Mumia and All Political Prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to give a brief public service announcement. There's going to be a protest against the Chronicle's lack of coverage on the Mumia Abu-Jamal case. And I believe they're not adequately reporting on the Arnold Beverly confession. That's going to be the San Francisco Chronicle Mass Pick a Line and Outreach Day is Saturday, September 15th, 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. picket, and then community outreach will be following after that at the Chronicle building at 5th and Mission Street in San Francisco. Then there's an urgent plea to come to Philadelphia to support Mumia at this very critical time. The defense has until September 7th to file papers on why the Arnold Beverly evidence is timely. The prosecution has 2 weeks after that to respond. So there's going to be a Philadelphia emergency action for Mumia. That's Saturday, September 15th at 11 a.m. There's going to be a mass demonstration at Philadelphia City Hall at 11 a.m. That's at 15th and Market Street in Philadelphia. And I guess if you want to fly over there, got next couple of days to still get a good deal on airplane tickets.
Now, if folks want to go up to this San Francisco rally at the Chronicle office, is there a caravan going up, or?
Not that I'm aware of at this time.
Mm-hmm.
About half of our coalition is going to Philadelphia this time, because we're determined to support Mumia that way.
I see. And nobody, is anyone driving? I know there are people just flying.
I think people are mostly flying to Philadelphia. The only person I know who might be driving is in Minnesota already.
Uh-huh, Steve Argue, perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, and if people want more information, what number can they call?
They can call 425-4467.
425-4467.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. There's also another little bit to this announcement, too.
Go ahead.
That is that if you want to basically call and or send a letter of protest to Judge Pamela Demby to demand diplomatically yet firmly that she grant a hearing at which the confession of Arnold Beverly to the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner should be admitted into evidence.
Mm-hmm.
There is no statute of limitations on murder. The address would be the Honorable Pamela Pryor Demby, Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas, Criminal Justice Center, Suite 1415, that's 1301 Filbert Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19107. The phone number for Pamela Demby is 215-683-7148. That's 215-683-7148. And the fax number is 215-683-7150.
Mm-hmm.
That's 215-683-7150.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the goal is to get the Arnold Beverly affidavits admitted so that we can clear Mumia of a crime that he didn't commit.
Mm-hmm. And
again, for those who didn't catch those numbers, they can call at what number to get them repeated?
They can call. Well, they can. I don't know if I have it on the voicemail right at the moment, but if they want more information, I can give them the numbers. If they leave their phone number at 425-4467.
Mm-hmm. 425-4467.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Anything else you want to add on that?
Oh, I don't know. I've been reading both the 275-page brief that the defense submitted, and I've also read parts of Executing Justice, and I don't know, it's looking pretty grim. Executing Justice, Dan Williams sides with Judge Sabo at least a couple of times in there already, and he's basically trying to make it look like Lemieux's guilty. He's trying to do that, I think. And I mean, he just leaves out arguments in favor of the defense a lot, mm-hmm. at least in the beginning, and then towards the end he's trying to trash defense witnesses and siding with Judge Sabo a couple of times. One, he said that it was reasonable for Judge Sabo to admit Priscilla Durham's typewritten, unsigned typewritten statement that she didn't write herself directly into evidence. And then there's the question of whether Cynthia White is dead.
Mm-hmm.
That was discredited, allegedly discredited, by a piece that, a fact sheet that, can't remember the guy's name, somebody from Refuse and Resist wrote.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the book, they're saying that, no, they've proven that Cynthia White is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm strongly questioning that.
You know, these are details that people listening in may not be really able to kind of put in any context. Are these books carried by the Santa Cruz Public Library?
Not that I'm aware of at mm-hmm. the moment. The 275-page brief, you can get that by calling Jeff Mackler
mm-hmm.
at the San Francisco Mobilization. You can get that number off of...
Maybe what I could do is just have them call your, you know, yeah. if people have inquiries about this, they can give a call to you,
right.
you know, at the appropriate place.
Yeah.
And, let's...
The 275-page brief does bring in some new ideas, such as the possibility that Robert Covert, one of the chief prosecution witnesses, told one of the private investigators of Leonard Weinglass, and Leonard Weinglass never brought this up at the 1995 PCRA hearing, unfortunately, but basically what the PI heard from Robert Covert was that Robert Covert was not parked behind the police car, and mm-hmm. he did not see Officer Faulkner get shot.
Right.
So there's a question about that now as well.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's what's happening with all that.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody wants to hear more about it, we have our meetings every Sunday in Loudoun Nelson Park
mm-hmm.
at 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
That's right behind the Loudoun Nelson Center on Sundays at 5 p.m.
Okay, and again, the number to call for more information is...
425-4467.
Alrighty.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you, John.
Okay, bye.
And we're entering the last minutes of Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. And coming up next, very soon, will be Uncle Dennis's show. If you want to contact Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides off-air, the number to call is 423-4833. It's a voicemail, but you can leave a message of anything up to 5 minutes in length, I believe. And if there's stuff you want broadcast, leave that, and I can put that on the next show, which is Sunday from 11 to 1:30. A couple of quick updates about Camp Paradise before I yield the mic to... Earth First, which is coming up, and hopefully we'll have some updates on Earth First. I'm not sure. I haven't spoken to Uncle Dennis, but usually he does a real good job of covering the local scene as well as the broader national scene. Camp Paradise, I checked out the criminal record of Camp Paradise founder Larry Templeton today. It was yesterday. I went down to the county courthouse, and what I found was that there are still... His record consists of one conviction for possession of more than an ounce of marijuana. That's his criminal record. It's not a felony. It's a misdemeanor. That's all they have on him. The things.